McKenzie, bringing you a road back to nature in Oroville, exploring natural farming, permaculture, community gardens, exploring the very foundation upon which our existence lies, and that's a relationship with this earth and naturally then where our food comes from. So this last couple of weeks, I've been sharing with you some chapters from this book, The One Straw Revolution, which I have my copy here that Fukuoka signed. And it's been read so many times, literally. It's such a wealth of information and an inspiration, I would say, giving you a sense of maybe not where to, what to do, but where, what not to do. Fukuoka was always, you know, looking at non-action, and instead of plowing, how could he work without plowing? Instead of, you know, weeding, how does he not weed? Instead of pruning, how does he not prune? How does he get away with not using, making compost? How does he, you know, it's always about what does nature do? Because nature doesn't have any big techniques and, you know, after the third month we do this and after the 6 months we do that. You know, nature is just in this very gentle and intense ongoing process of life. So I guess that very essence of life is what Fukuoka perceived as being all, you know, all powerful and amazing capacity to manifest. So it was that he was trying to get to. Anyway, so this book really exemplifies this, shows the with very clear examples how this non-dualistic, non-intrusive philosophy into farming actually works. And we're on the third and another chapter now, a third chapter that I'm reading called Drifting Clouds and the Illusion of Science. And it's on page 164, if you have your book there with you. And, you know, this is really pretty the hardcore philosophy of it, of what, you know, how our minds are actually defining everything. And we don't really see what's there. This morning, I am washing citrus storage boxes by the river. As I stoop on a flat rock, my hands feel the chill of the autumn river. The red leaves of the sumacs along the riverbank stand out against the clear blue autumn sky. I am struck with wonder by the unexpected splendor of the branches against the sky. Within this casual scene, the entire world of experience is present. In the flowing water, the flow of time, the left bank and right bank, the sunshine and shadows, the red leaves and blue sky, all appear within the sacred silent book of nature, and man is a slender, thinking reed. Once he inquires what nature is, he then must inquire what that what is, and what that human who inquires what that what is. He heads, that is to say, into a world of endless questioning. In trying to gain a clear understanding of what it is that fills him with wonder, what it is that astonishes him, he has two possible paths. The first is to look deeply into himself, at him who asks the question, what is nature? The second is to examine nature apart from man. The first path leads to the realm of philosophy and religion. Gazing vacantly, it is not unnatural to see the water as flowing from above to below, but there is no inconsistency in seeing the water as standing still and the bridge as flowing by. If, on the other hand, following the second path, the scene is divided into a variety of natural phenomena, the water, the speed of the current, the waves, the wind and white clouds, all of these separately become objects of investigation, leading to further questions which spread out endlessly in all directions. This is the path of science. The world used to be simple. You merely noticed in passing that you got wet by brushing against the drops of dew while meandering through the meadow. But from the time people undertook to explain this one drop of dew scientifically, they trapped themselves in the endless hell of the intellect. Water molecules are made up of atoms of hydrogen and oxygen. People once thought that the smallest particles in the world were atoms, but then they found out there was a nucleus inside the atom. Now they have discovered that within the nucleus there are even tinier particles. Among these nuclear particles, there are hundreds of different varieties, and no one knows where the examination of this minute world will end. It is said that the way electrons orbit at ultra-high speeds within the atom is exactly like the flight of comets within the galaxy. To the atomic physicist, the world of elementary particles is a world as vast as the universe itself. Yet it has been shown that in addition to the immediate galaxy in which we live, there are countless other galaxies. In the eyes of the cosmologist, then, our entire galaxy becomes infinitesimally small. The fact is that people who think that a drop of water is simple, or that a rock is fixed and inert, are happy, ignorant fools. And the scientists who know that the drop of water is a great universe, and the rock is an active world of elementary particles streaming about like rockets, are clever fools. Looked at simply, this world is real and at hand. Seen as complex, the world becomes frighteningly abstract and distant. The scientists who rejoiced when rocks were brought back from the moon have less grasp of the moon than the children who sing out, "How old are you, Mr. Moon?" Basho, the well-known haiku poet, could apprehend the wonder of nature by watching the reflection of the full moon in the tranquility of a pond. All the scientists did, when they went off into space and stomped around in their space boots, was to tarnish a bit of the moon's splendor for millions of lovers and children on the Earth. How is it that people think science is beneficial to humanity? Well, originally, grain was ground into flour in this village by a stone mill, which was turned slowly by hand. Then a water mill, which had incomparably greater momentum than the old stone grinder, was built to utilize the power of the river current. Several years ago, a dam was constructed to produce hydroelectrical power, and an electrically powered mill was built. How do you think this advanced machinery works for the benefit of human beings? In order to grind rice into flour, it is first polished, that is, made into white rice. This means husking the grain, removing the germ and the bran, which are the basis of good health, and keeping the leftovers. In Japanese, the character for leftovers, pronounced kasu, is composed of radicals meaning white and rice. And so the result of this technology, the leftovers is white and rice, and the character for bran, nuka, is made up of rice and health. And so the result of this technology is the breaking down of the whole grain into incomplete byproducts. If the too easily digestible white rice becomes the daily staple, the diet lacks nutrients, and dietary supplements become necessary. The water wheel and the milling factory are doing the work of the stomach and intestines, and their consequence is to make these organs lazy. It is the same with fuel. Crude oil is formed when the tissues of ancient plants buried deep in the earth is transformed by great pressure and heat. This substance is dug out of the desert, sent to a port by pipeline, and then transported by boat to Japan and refined into kerosene and oil at a big refinery. Which do you think is quicker, warmer and more convenient, burning this kerosene or branches of cedar or pine from in front of the house? The fuel is the same plant matter. The oil and kerosene just followed a longer path in getting here. Now they are saying that the fossil fuels are not enough and that we need to develop atomic energy to search out the scarce uranium ore, compress it into radioactive fuel, and burn it in a huge nuclear furnace is not as easy as burning dried leaves with a match. Moreover, the hearth fire leaves only ashes, but after a nuclear fire has burned, the radioactive waste remains dangerous for many thousands of years. The same principle holds in agriculture. Grow a soft, fat rice plant in a flooded field and you get a plant easily attacked by insects and disease. If improved seed varieties are used, one must rely on the help of chemical insecticides and fertilizers. On the other hand, if you grow a small, sturdy plant in a healthy environment, these chemicals are unnecessary. Cultivate a flooded rice field with a plow or tractor and the soil becomes deficient in oxygen. The soil structure is broken down, earthworms and other small animals are destroyed, and the earth becomes hard and lifeless. Once this happens, the field must be turned every year. But if a method is adopted in which the earth cultivates itself naturally, there is no need for a plow or cultivating machine. After the living soil is burned clean of organic matter and microorganisms, the use of fast-acting fertilizers becomes necessary. If chemical fertilizer is used, the rice grows fast and tall, but so do the weeds. Herbicides are then applied and thought to be beneficial. But if clover is sown within the grain and all the straw and organic residues are returned to the surface of the field as mulch, crops can be grown without herbicide, chemical fertilizer, or prepared compost. In farming like this, there is little that cannot be eliminated. Prepared fertilizer, herbicide, insecticides, machinery, all are unnecessary. But if a condition is created in which they become necessary, then the power of science is required. I have demonstrated in my fields that natural farming produces harvests comparable to those of modern scientific agriculture. If the results of a non-active agriculture are comparable to those of science, at a fraction of the investment in labor and resources, then where is the benefit of scientific technology? So that was The Drifting Clouds and the Illusion of Science, Masanobu Fukuoka, page 164, The One Straw Revolution. I'd best just let that sit with you for a while, because all of these things, you know, just need some time to have a digest, and maybe next week we'll talk about it, if you like. Thank you very much, and I'll see you next week.
என்மேல் கோபமா பேசம்மா ஒரு மொழி பேசம்மா என் பாலைவனத்தில் உந்தன் பார்வை யாரு வந்து பாய்ந்திடுமா உன் ஊடல் தீர்வதற்குள் எந்த ஜீவன் மெல்ல ஓய்ந்திடுமா உள்ளுயிரே உருகுதம்மா என்மேல் கோபமா பேசமா ஒரு மொழி பேசமா என் பாலைவனத்தில் உந்தன் பார்வை யாரு வந்து பாய்ந்திடுமா உன் ஊடல் தீர்வதற்குள் எந்த ஜீவன் மெல்ல ஓய்ந்திடுமா உள்ளுயிரே உருகுதமா என்மேல் கோபமா
வானம் இடியுமடி, உன் பாதம் படிகின்ற சிறு துகளில் என் ஆவி துடிக்குதடி. கோபமா என் மேல் கோபமா, என் மாற்று தீரடி பெண்ணே, அதில் முகம் தோன்றிடும் கண்ணே, என் மாற்று தீரடி பெண்ணே, அதில் முகம் தோன்றிடும் கண்ணே. கண்கள் சாமரம் வீசிடுமா, இல்லை காயத்தில் கத்தி வீசிடுமா? கோபமா என் மேல் கோபமா?
Oui, vous écoutez Auroville Radio from Auroville, la ville internationale in India.